All right, so what I'll do is, while it's loading, just get started. One of the advantages of doing two presentations at the same time is I get to sort of do a do-over. And by that I mean, when I started, I was so eager to get started, I didn't give credit to my co-investigators, and I really want to do so by name because I really have been privileged to work with a fabulous team of researchers. So one is Michelle Tatey, who was with the Drexel, she used to be with the Drexel School of Public Health, and she's now University of Missouri at Columbia. David Malebranche, is my co-investigator as well. Many of you know David from Emory University. Aditi Patel was a graduate student at Drexel who worked with us on the analyses of masculinity ideologies. And Jean Tachan, who is with the University of California at San Francisco. She's affiliated, and I really like to tout this program any opportunity I have, with the Center for AIDS Prevention Studies and the Visiting Professors Program, which trains people who are interested in doing ethnic minority research in HIV to write R01s and other NIH funding. I can't say enough about this. And so any of you who are interested in a program such as that, you really want to get check out the CAPS-VP program. And Janae Massey, who is my fabulous project director, helped put together these slides. She's somewhere here today. Right up front. So what I'm going to do now is, so I'm talking about the same study. So this is the same Represent study, the same study that was funded by National Institutes of Health, specifically National Institutes of Child Health and Human Development, and talk about what the men are saying about gender roles and masculinity ideologies, or about HIV risk and masculinity ideologies. No relationships to disclose. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, just review the literature briefly, talk about the findings. What we did is we wanted to analyze explicit ideologies. And so when I'm talking about masculinity ideologies, I'm sort of using them sort of synonymously with gender role norms. And what I'm talking about are these sort of culturally accepted standards about what it means to be a boy or a man in our society. And so we wanted to look at the explicit, what guys said, but we also wanted to look at their analyses and see what they imply. So things that they did not say, but they may also have implications for sexual risk. All right, but first, before I get to that, you know, sort of a few caveats. One of the problems with doing this type of research is, you know, particularly when I'm standing up here and I'm talking about what the men are saying about sex with multiple women and all that, is this sort of tendency to stigmatize black men. And I want to make it clear that that's sort of the last thing that's on my agenda. And so towards the end, when I talk about sort of like what does this all mean, I really try so much to frame this within sort of the structural context of black men's lives. And so it's very important that I put that out there, that that's not my goal in presenting this information. The other thing is the importance of counter-narrative. So for pretty much everything that I'm going to share with you in terms of the findings about what the men said about their gender ideologies, there are men saying, no, not me, I'm monogamous, or there are men who are not saying homophobic things. And so that's the other important point. To state the obvious, when you're speaking with a group of men, they speak in explicit language. And so you're going to get a little taste of that, but just a little taste. But I just want to let you know, and the other things that you may find offensive, and that you'll hear me sort of go back and forth. Sometimes I say masculinity ideology, sometimes I say gender role norms. Basically, I'm using these terms synonymously. Okay. So I've already sort of defined what I'm talking about when I say masculinity ideologies. And why it's important to look at these masculinity ideologies and HIV risk is that we have empirical research, most of it done, however, with multi-ethnic groups of adolescents or predominantly white samples of college students that show that men who score higher on these sort of traditional masculinity ideologies, you know, things like, you know, the man should be in charge, that kind of stuff, that is predictive of them having more sexual partners, less consistent condom use, less belief that they should be responsible for contraception, and just having more negative attitudes towards condoms. One of the things that's really surprising is how little research there is on this topic in the U.S. Because if you look at research done in other places, Julie Pulvowitz has done really fantastic work in places like Brazil, Ethiopia, Tanzania, and India, on and on. You have all of these studies and interventions trying to intervene against these traditional masculinity ideologies in ways that are really, really good, have shown really good effects in terms of reducing risk. But in this country, for some reason, this research on adult men has not been has not happened as much. A notable exception is a study that some of you may have seen by Carrie et al. In AIDS and Behavior, just focused on black men's norms about having multiple partners. But other than that, it's really sort of a dearth. All right, so we wanted to know, pretty simply, what do they say? What are the things that men actually say about these masculinity ideologies that may have implications for risk? And then what's more sort of implicit, what's sort of implied? And so for this phase, and so remember this is, I'm still talking about the study that I talked about earlier, where in the first phase we did focus groups and interviews. And so whereas I presented to you interviews, this is just focused on focus groups. And we did six groups, and they were facilitated by black male interviewers. David Malebranche was one. Boy, I tell you, he is a model for the ultimate co-investigator. He will leave his busy studies to come to Philadelphia to do interviews. He's that kind of, he's just fantastic. So sample questions we ask them is, you know, what are some of the expectations that they should do? And they, you know, made a list of that and discussed all of that. And then what are some of the things that black men should not do or should not be? And then we, you know, we recorded, we transcribed all of this, and we independently coded. And here are some of the things that we found. Before I get there, let me tell you a little bit about who we're talking about. 41 men. They're a larger age range than the interviews, and it's slightly different. If you think about the interviewees that I presented earlier, who were a larger portion of them were unemployed. In this sample, the incomes are higher, less unemployment. So their income range from less than $10,000 a year to $60,000. The majority reported at least having a high school degree or a GED. 29% work full-time, 29% were unemployed, and so it was really sort of much more diverse, socioeconomically diverse than our interview sample. All right, so explicit and implicit. So there's two things that the guy said, and they said it clearly. One, black men should have sex with multiple women. That's just part of being a black man, and I'll show you some of the quotes, specifically what they said. And black men should not be gay or bisexual, and they had a lot to say about, you know, used a lot of stereotypic terms. Again, the importance of, I want to reinforce, of the counter-narrative. It was not all of them, but these were sort of the salient themes. And in terms of implicit, this notion that if you're going to get sex, you better get it. Like, you know, you can't decline it. And so we have narratives of men even, you know, like, even engaging in sex that they think is risky. And one of the men in the focus groups used this term about, boy, it's really bad to go to bed haunted, you know, by could I have gotten something? But this notion, like, they just can't control it. If there's sex, you got to get it. And then the second thing was that women are primarily responsible or should be responsible for condom use. So let me show you how this shakes out. This is sort of an overall quote that really sort of encapsulates, though, the sort of challenge of masculinity that I wanted to share with you, again, articulated by one of the men in the group, that sort of ties everything together. And he says, you know, how do we deal with the consequences of being a man in the black community, especially when it comes to the tough guy image, screwing all the women, all the different women, you know, knocking somebody upside the head when they so-called disrespect you, so this notion about, you know, respect. And sometimes we fall into our own trap of what does it really mean to be a man? We get that really confused and distorted. And that's a good question. What does it take to be a man? What is a real man? And so this provides the title for this presentation. All right. So explicit MI, and so I'm going to say MI, I mean masculine and ideology one. She's John's on the side. My team always laughs at me. Anybody who's been in Philadelphia knows that John is a sort of term in the Philadelphians use, and it's for everything. It's like, you know, like this John right here, you know, pass me that John. But anyway, and it also refers to multiple partners, and so this is sort of, and it came up over and over and over. And so here are just sort of some snippets of what the men said in these focus groups. Black men feel like you're not a man unless you have a whole lot of partners, multiple partners, and that if you do not have as many so-called freaky experiences as possible, you're not a man. That's society's expectations on us, and we, of course, have bought into those similar stereotypes. And then, of course, you know, there's this lively discussion. I should say these discussions were lively. I was not in the room. I wanted to be in the room. You know, the research suggests that, you know, the discourse is kind of different with a woman there. But, you know, there are these, the discourse, men are cutting into, you know, they're interrupting each other. And so in the context of in the course of this discussion about the multiple partners, you know, this guy asked me, like, what black heterosexual man don't want all the pussy he can get? And then, you know, there was this other discussion about, you know, men who are monogamous versus non-monogamous. And one of the men said, well, every one of those men that tell you you can't have no other women is going to go outside their circle at least 99% of the time. What, are you kidding me? Another one. This was a quote that one of the guys says, you know, a man wasn't made for a man. So the other explicitly stated norm is that you shouldn't be gay or bisexual. And of course, this has implications for risk that I'll talk about in a little bit. So one, real black men are heterosexual. Us as African-American black men, we macho, you know, manly men, forts and stuff like meat and potatoes. And for us, we don't want to be represented by some fairy. We talk about being black men, and they meaning gay and bisexual black men. They're the antithesis of that. And so one of the ways that I'm interested in this, you know, a lot of this discourse is about men who may feel, because if this is the case, then you have to sort of prove your heterosexuality. And one way you can do that, of course, is through having sex with lots of women. And so this is an important one to explore further. And then the second sub-theme was this notion that it was those men over there, those gay and bisexual men, those, not us, are transmitting HIV to black heterosexual communities. And this was really amazing to me because there was a lot of discourse about the promiscuity of gay and bisexual men and men on the down low with absolutely sort of no sort of critical reflection about, you know, this whole, how that is the same thing as the multiple partners. But those are sort of two separate things, and those sort of never came together. And so this is one man saying, and then you have the switch hitters. That's what I call them, guys that like men and women. So when people are out there having casual sex out here like that, it gets scary because you won't know what the switch got you. And you bring it in, transmitting it, diseases and stuff over to the straight community. And so, you know, it was this notion of this danger. And I said in my earlier presentation that I think there is a way that we have really gotten distracted by this whole down low. And it's great to hear even the CDC coming out and saying, wait, I mean, we can't focus there. The numbers are so small. And with common sense, had just stopped to think about it, you think there just can't be that many bisexual people in the world. But there's this way that we sort of jumped on this, you know, like, oh yeah, they're responsible for transmitting. And it's really distracted us and further stigmatized black MSM. Now I'm going to talk about the implicit stuff. Again, this is not what they said, but this is what our analyses showed. So this notion that, you know, you cannot decline sex when confronted with sexual desire, either your own sexual desire or a female partner's sexual desire. And so this guy in one of the groups, he sort of poses this question to the group. What do you think is the most powerful weapon on earth? Woman, the most powerful thing on earth is pussy. And, you know, this notion that they're just like, it's like kryptonite. And then this is, you know, the second quote is, you know, we've heard this before. I mean, in terms of people just being so overcome by sexual desire that they can't use condoms. So it's certainly not unique to this population. But, you know, here's a man talking about, like, you could plan to use a Trojan. You could have a Trojan, anything. And she could have one. You get heated, you know, y'all over, whatever, kissing and whatever, like grinding, whatever the situation is and stuff. Clothes start coming off, like, but your attention was to strap up. But you got heated, like, shit happens. This one, women should be responsible for condom use. Basically, it's women's fault. And this man is saying, I never raise a condom issue. Before we have sex, it's like she says, yo, take off the condom or you ain't going to use the condom. It's like rarely do I ever have a girl say, here, use this condom before we even get down, before we start having sex. Another discussion was, a lot of women don't say nothing about using condoms. And this one, this last one, I mean, takes the cake. Women don't care, and that could stop a lot of the issues in terms of the transmission of STIs. And so this, to me, probably speaks of how little we have engaged men who have sex with women in terms of HIV prevention efforts, about their responsibility. And so they're talking about this just completely absolved of agency about how they can prevent HIV. So some implications about this. Clearly, we need more research with this population, just and other adult male populations, particularly in light of these promising interventions that they're doing in all these other countries. And in most of the, one, there's so few interventions for black heterosexual men in general, but most of them don't really even incorporate a gender role norm or masculinity ideology component. Another implication is, how do we discuss this work without stigmatizing a group that's already stigmatized? You can see how, you know, in the wrong hands, people can just take this and roll with it. Oh, yeah, those black people, they just want to have sex. Now, but what is heartening is that all of this research showing that, you know, black people aren't doing anything riskier than other groups. The problem is that HIV is far more densely concentrated in the networks in our communities, which means that when you step outside and you engage in sex with other partners, there's a higher probability for transmittal. So I think that's a really important point to get across. The structural context, talking about this within the structural context of men's lives. So how do factors such as poverty, unemployment, not being able to sort of attain these sort of idealized standards of what it means to be a man, how might those be related to risk? If a man can't get a job, feels really terrible about that, but one of the things that is valued is, and again, it's not just for black men, but valued in the culture is, like, you know, maybe a man who's a player, has got a lot of women, that's valued. Maybe, you know, so we really need to put this in context. And lastly, just on interventions, and we need interventions to do several things. One, we need interventions to challenge black men's biphobia and homophobia. We can't let that go unchecked. They need to be sort of challenged on that. To raise these issues of changing inequitable norms between men and women, emphasizing male responsibility for condom use. I mean, with the exception of the female condoms, the male condoms are used most frequently. They fit on the male body. I mean, as I said before, I'm just baffled by how we've sort of let men off the hook with that, heterosexual men off the hook in terms of HIV prevention. We need to challenge men with these ideologies that protect, that increase risk. So challenging this notion like, okay, wait, you're talking about these down low brothers and how out of control they are, but yet you're sitting here telling me about all the women, you're looking pretty out of control to me too, you know, and there's a need to sort of challenge that. There's also a need to find out about what are the ideologies and norms that really might protect against risk. Right? I mean, there's things that we probably don't even know about that can be really, you know, things about respect, loving the community, and intervening in that regard. And again, I this is always my take-home point, addressing the structural context of black men's lives, looking at in terms of poverty, incarceration, unemployment, and on, and integrating that into our HIV prevention work. Thank you.
Moderator, so I'll.
I have a couple of questions. One for you, Dr. Spelzak. Do you feel like your STI rates were actually underestimated due to the subspot?
No.
The question?
She asked whether or not I felt that the STD rates that we saw in the study were underrepresented. She asked whether I felt that the STD rates in the study were lower because it was self-collected vaginal swab specimens. We've used that procedure in many other studies. Gosh, if 34% was low, I'd hate to think, in the community-based sample. In the other studies, we've never had any reason to believe that there was any issue. It's pretty easy procedure, and we had a detailed instruction card for them to take into the bathroom to use the swab, and we trained them for just briefly a couple minutes before they went in the bathroom.
Are you asking partners engaging in commercial sex or something?
The partners of the trans women having sex with sex workers outside of those relationships?
sex workers with other trans women, you know, and also we didn't ask for other, you know, I mean, type of sex workers, you know. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about male sex?
I'm talking about any sex
workers. I think we have data about, you know, those engaging in another trans woman who engaging in sex work. Yeah, so they have certainly engaging in, yeah, sex with other trans sex workers. Yes, outside population too. I mean, outside of relationship. Yeah, so they have right now they have primary partners, you know, and then those primary, you know, male partners, those they are, I think, 8%. They said, you know, engaging in other trans women, and probably more than half are those trans women who engaging in sex work.
Traditional venue for such a study. I'm thinking that women also may be accompanied by children. So what did your approach look like?
That's a really good question. So she asked, for my study, we did venue-based sampling, and the two venues we used were public libraries that a lot of African-American women attended. Some women did have children, and if they were able to put the children in, like, the children's section of the library and kind of watch them at the same time, then that worked out. So several women did have children with them. But we would just approach them as they came into the library and ask them quickly if they could answer a few, you know, brief questions regarding being in a study. And for those who said yes, there were a few women who didn't have time, but that was a small number. But it worked out really well.
Talk a little bit about how did you recruit these black men? Because we hear a lot about, you know, black men don't want to participate in research. And then talk a little bit about what was your main aha moment. I saw a few, but I'm seeing all sorts of implications for future studies.
Oh, yeah? Okay, so his question, well, Sheldon has a voice that, so you heard his question, recruitment. We use this sort of venue-based sampling. What we did is and they're sort of different, because for this, for the focus groups and the interviews, we are blessed in Philadelphia to have a 43% black population. So we had recruiters who just went out as part of the canvassing we were doing for the larger study. And for that, what we did is we randomly selected U.S. Census block tracts that had a population of 50% or more black people. And we had teams, Janae headed that up, who went to these different neighborhoods, and they went to the different venues, and they, during specific times, they noted the amount of black men who looked to be between the age ranges. They and they went several times to do that, and then they got the permission of the venue owners to come in and do their surveys. The canvassing was really important, but also difficult, because, you know, sometimes they would go and venues would close. That was pretty much the procedure. In terms of aha moments, oh my God, they don't end with this. You know, it's sort of like there's just so many. The homophobia part, the multiple sex partners is not really new. I'm thinking about the first presentation, the structural context of black men's lives and how important that is, and that's sort of not out there in the literature, and how important it is to really see, you know, is that related to HIV risk and how? And to, you know, I didn't go in, when we designed the study, police harassment was not one of our questions, for example. And there it is, over and over and over. We asked questions in the quantitative phase about neighborhood context, but in the quality, we didn't even ask specifically about that, and there it is just everywhere. We asked about incarceration quantitatively, but we didn't really have specific questions about that in the qualitative, but there it is everywhere. And so I think the aha is, oh, wait a minute, you know, we can't sort of just narrow in on sort of HIV. There's a larger story here about the lives of black people in this country, particularly black people who are poor, who are dealing with racism and stress every day. And why are we surprised? You know, and that you can also include other things, you know, like, okay, take out HIV, put in TB, put in hypertension, you know, and so I guess it's a larger sort of, it's not so much of an aha, but a larger sort of understanding of what it means to be sort of black and male and in many of these cases unemployed and have incarceration histories in the US. Long answer, but. Oh,
Actually, I'm with the Center for Studies of Disparity in Pennsylvania, and we have a children's study looking at African American males in college and just how that social network helps with wellness and their wellness behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And so the recruitment piece was big about how do you actually get, again, black men to come and talk to you about these issues, like listen to the parents. So I want to hear about your recruitment assistants. What do they look like? How do they really draw?
I'm going to have Janae come up and talk about that. But one thing I want to say, you know, I was sort of baffled about, you know, you always hear about these hard-to-reach populations. You know, that was not our experience. And in the with the qualitative phase, we had some challenges with the quantitative phase, but men were eager and hungry. I mean, you know, David and I talked a lot about almost like the groups become therapy in and of themselves. You know, men want to know, when are you doing more groups? When can we come and talk? Where can we, you know, we don't have an opportunity to talk like this. And so that was not our experience. But since Janae headed up the recruitment, she was like out in the field. I'll have her talk a little bit about
Hi, how's everyone doing? As far as recruitment, when it comes to the staff that we hired to do the recruitment, it was a big part. There was a few things. One, the whole idea was that we were going to be going out in these neighborhoods. Not all of them were the safest neighborhoods. It comes down to a lot of you being a face that they recognize. So one, we looked for people that were familiar with Philadelphia, meaning that if I'm going to send you to West Philly, South Philly, North Philly, Overbrook, wherever, you're going to feel comfortable in the neighborhood enough that you know where's the public transportation in case you need to leave, like, you know.
Which we had to do.
Yes. So, like, feeling comfortable in general in your environment. That was probably the biggest thing. When you send someone out and they feel uncomfortable, the men, the women, everyone around there can tell you're uncomfortable. There were times we would go out and they would think we were police or from the health department and just feel uncomfortable in order to answer those questions. So we went through a lot of training before we sent them out on the kind of questions that you're going to encounter, how you're going to deal with it. So it was feeling comfortable with Philadelphia, feeling comfortable talking in these neighborhoods and addressing any of the issues that come up and some of the safety concerns and stuff like that. We did have a mixed gender group, so we had males and females. They all did happen to be African American. That wasn't how we planned it. It wasn't as if like we didn't interview other people. It just ended up that those were the people that seemed to feel the most comfortable with the idea. And we did have some people that did go out and then immediately knew that this was not for them, you know. And so that was another big issue was, since it was part-time work also, making sure that you could keep hiring new people to fill in your gaps for what you needed. Because there were some people that it wasn't for them. Once they got out there and having a deal with everything, it wasn't the best. And sometimes venue owners were the problems. It wasn't always the men. A lot of times with the men, once you establish what you were there for, and we told them, you know, we're out here trying to find out more about black men's health because no one else is. And from there, they were like, I'm with you, you know? And a lot of times once you would be out there, because some venues we would end up going to more than once just because of the random sampling. So if we were out there one day and maybe I met Joe and Michael, when they see me next day, oh, you know, I know some people that might want to come talk to you. So now you've established your presence in that neighborhood. So that also helps. So I hope that answered your question.
Can I say something? I'm just going to mention something real quick. That I teach, you know, program planning classes and intervention designs, you know, to undergrads. And we keep talking about cultural competency and of the people who go do research. And I think to me, this is the application of if you are culturally competent and if you empower your target population that they know you care, it's really easy to reach your target population to get them involved. And I think you guys did a great job of, you know, recruiting these people. So
I want to say one other thing because so it's one thing to recruit them and to get them to study and to, you know, come to APA and do the presentations and get the publications, but, you know, often the research doesn't get back to the community. So the next thing we're doing is we have a community dissemination plan where we're going to have different events throughout Philadelphia, all sorts of, you know, we have just a list of ideas, and it actually was something that we built into the research to disseminate the findings back to the community, back to different organizations and the men who participated, because that's critical too. I think we only have like 2 minutes, but for me, okay.
I'm wondering if you had any insight into the role of African-American churches in creating the cultural norms that you identified. I was struck by the fact that so many African-American churches have been outspoken in favor of homophobia,
mm-hmm.
particularly politically.
Yeah.
I'm from the District of Columbia, very important political activity there. One would expect that the African American church would be against many sexual partners for heterosexual men, yet that message doesn't seem to have taken any insight into.
Yeah, no, I don't, and I don't want to, you know, it's not my area of expertise, and I don't want to go beyond the data. I mean, in our study, I mean, men aren't talking about that so much. I mean, you hear this, you know, man was not made for a man. But in Philadelphia, we also have a sizable black Muslim population. I think it would be one of the largest outside of Michigan. And so that kept coming up over and over. So it wasn't sort of the Christian stuff that we heard it was, you know, oh, well, as a Muslim, I can't, you know, do this and that. And so I can't speak beyond the data.
Have you considered trying to replicate this program around the country in major inner cities? Go down south, northwest, the west coast, and see and make a comparison among the groups of men that you recruited for the study and see what you.
Well, here's the next step, and I'm working on now. We are working on a grant application to test a structural intervention that has unemployment and housing for black heterosexual men, and see in Philadelphia, and then based on that, see if there's, you know, if we can have an efficacious intervention for dissemination, but we don't know, but that's the next step. So we are out of time, unfortunately. I'd like to thank you all for coming.